All right, today is September 19th, 2013. This is Adam Chile, PhD candidate in the Department of History. And I'm here in the office of Ivan Fernandez to talk about his experiences with the Climate Change Institute. So just to get us started off, I'm wondering if you could tell me a little bit about how you got interested in soil science.
Soil science. When I was looking at graduate schools, I was not looking for programs in soil science specifically, but programs in natural resources and the environment. And I met a professor that was a soil scientist who had an assistantship opportunity, and he explained what that would be about, and so I went home and thought about the different opportunities that I had learned about in my travels in making that decision. And I decided that sounded pretty interesting, the area of science that they were going to work on. And then when I started to become a graduate student in soil science, it was one of these things where you really sort of find your calling. I thought it was really cool, and I enjoyed it a lot, and the more of it I did, the more I enjoyed it. So I kept on doing it. And went on and got a PhD, and the rest is history, as they say.
Mm-hmm. What did you do for your undergraduate, if not?
I was a biology major, so more of a broad general. Actually, I was a plant biology person by way of focus, and so my senior project had to do with taxonomy of plants and the Bahamas, or a small Bahama island. And so I really hadn't worked outside of a rudimentary level in soils at all. I knew they existed. I knew they were part of ecology, but I was really a plant person at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. So something, your relationship with your advisor as a master's student.
First as a master's student, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what turned you on to soil science.
Yeah.
What was it about the discipline?
Well, probably a couple of things. One, I hadn't thought about it before, and as I learned how important soils were from the standpoint of environmental issues and ecosystem function and what now we would call ecosystem services, but at the time we weren't using that vernacular, I became increasingly intrigued with learning more about it. It was also an area that there seemed to be a lot of interesting questions to pursue, and there were a lot more people who were interested in flowers and furry critters and, you know, wildlife biology and botany and plant ecology and things like that. But there wasn't that many people in soils, particularly in areas that were more of the traditional soils focus was in agriculture. And I was increasingly interested in forest soils and environmental issues related to those kinds of concerns. And so it was relatively self-reinforcing. The more I worked in that area, the more I became intrigued. The more I became intrigued and had knowledge in it, the more I felt I could add important new aspects that weren't present in collaborative efforts and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And kept on going from there.
How did you come to get involved with the Quaternary Institute?
So that question is, the first question sort of starts on the beginning of my career, and the second question starts at the, I'm still around, so I guess I'm not sure when the end of my career is, but obviously more up to the present. And so the arc of that, I would describe very briefly as the arc of that journey for me was to get involved with soils and find that, you know, as a research scientist, and I worked for industry for a few years, and then I came back and to this position at the university. And so I increasingly was doing research on ecosystem processes and environmental issues at the system level, with my own particular depth and expertise in soils being the specific contribution. But I wasn't just doing research on, you know, just soils per se, but more the ecosystem, which I did, you know, I continue to do, having to do with everything from the molecular to the landscape response to primarily environmental concerns having to do with the atmosphere, but not solely. I view my research as being about the biogeochemistry of forests, focusing on soils with an emphasis on how perturbations, primarily air pollution, climate change, and residuals, sludge and ash kind of land applications, alter those ecosystem processes. Mm-hmm. And probably 20 years ago, what was a primary focus on acid rain and atmospheric deposition of pollutants, metals as well, broadened to be the emerging concern for rising CO2 and changing climate. Both really important components of climate change, because CO2 is a fertilizer for forests as well. And obviously climate change is warming and all the things we know that are associated with that issue. And I always worked with one colleague, Steve Norton, my whole career here, fortunately. And he was in the Quaternary Institute for all of his career, so I knew about it, but I wasn't doing, I don't do, my research is not in deep time, so I'm not a paleoecologist, I'm not a, climate modeler. I don't, you know, ice cores and things like that that go back into deep time is not something I bring to the table by my skill set. I'm very much a contemporary ecosystem function person. But as the climate change concern grew, my interests in effects on ecosystems, their services, and how we both mitigate, like carbon storage and the forests of Maine, as well as adapt, I became increasingly interested in those. And as I did, I knew more of the people in the Climate Institute and eventually became part of the Climate Institute. So for, I don't know how long, but yeah, over the last decade, I've been part of the Climate Change Institute involved with its various activities.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you can elaborate a bit on your collaborative work with Stephen Norton.
Sure. He's a geochemist in earth science and the Climate Change Institute. I'm a soil scientist, mostly biogeochemistry. So early on, particularly at one of the long-term paired watershed research sites that we have, we began to collaborate. I was the soils person, he was the geochemistry person. There was a fisheries person that was part of it at the time. That was productive, enjoyable. That project still exists, the Bear Brook Watershed in Maine. And from there, we continued to collaborate on a number of different projects and still do today, mm-hmm. since I don't really recognize his formal retirement, so I keep him busy and we still enjoy doing science together. Mm-hmm. So like most collaborations in this university's, it's a small university, and one of the advantages that I always say to new faculty and hiring and things like that is we're not an institution that has lots of administrative walls, so you can pretty much work with whoever you want to work with that makes sense scientifically as well as from the standpoint of people chemistry, so that you're having fun and it's productive. And Steve's certainly one of those people for me, and we've enjoyed working together on a number of different projects for a long time.
I see. Have you participated in collaborative research with any other members of the Institute?
Oh, other members of the Institute. Yes. Well, right now I'm one of the co-PIs on the Abrupt Climate Change IGRT that we have in the Institute for primarily training PhD students in that area that has a, well, yeah, period. So Jasmine Saros and Paul Majewski and I forget who else is on that, but a number of different faculty, Brian Olson, that are in the Institute. Yeah, there's a bunch of people that are associated with that. Outside of that, as far as formal classic research grants, it's mostly been Steve Norton. I've done a lot of things that weren't formal research grants with George Jacobson, with Paul Majewski, and Jasmine Saros. Yeah. So my appointment has been and is still in really multiple units, some direct, some cooperating. So I've been part of what now is the School of Food and Agriculture, but that's a new school as of 6 months ago. So where were we?
Collaborative research with other members of the Institute.
Oh, and so I was just explaining that because I'm associated with some people dealing with environmental science and soils and the School of Food and Agriculture, my direct appointment's actually in the School of Forest Resources, so I collaborate with some people there, as well as people at other institutions and other agencies. Mm-hmm. So a good example of it doesn't matter what unit they're in or even who their formal employer is. It's a lot of fun to pull together people that are interested in working on a problem that enjoy working with each other.
Sure.
And so that's what we do.
How do you think plant science informs climate science and vice versa?
So I'll first ask...
soil science, I'm sorry. Not
no, no, yeah, well, that was what I was going to add. Obviously, you know, everyone in their own field is going to pick apart terminology. So do you really mean specifically soil science? Do you mean ecosystem science? Do you mean biogeochemistry, that kind of thing? Or basically what I do, how does it inform?
Sure, yes.
Okay. So what I do is study how the ecosystem, and most of mine are forest ecosystems, and so that means the trees, the understory, the soils, the microbes, the mammals, the water, streamwater, lakes, groundwater, and the interacting atmosphere, how that system is working together biologically and chemically, and then how whatever the vector of change is that is of interest alters that system and why we care and how much we know about it, how will it change, and can we predict it going into the future. So for climate change, the kinds of things that I do are getting at the question of what's being altered in the system. And if you include chemical and physical climate change, that means atmospheric pollutants, deposition, nitrogen, sulfur, as well as temperature, moisture, rainfall, those sorts of things. And why do we care? It could affect the kinds of forests we have, the kinds of habitat that exists, what we produce from our forests by way of wood. We store carbon in our forests, the quality of the water from forested landscapes, exchanges of CO2 with the atmosphere, and therefore the feedback with the climate system as well as with water. So I'm not a modeler per se, so I don't build the model, but we'll use them, and the models are built on the kind of data that I generate because we're doing the sort of empirical science in that regard. You know, a lot of what I've done, I think, in the Institute to some extent has been an extension of that science to policy. Because of my involvement and my thinking about the issues of climate change from the standpoint of how ecosystems respond, that's eventually brought me to in recent years being more concerned about how that science is informing policy and management, what we're doing about it. Are we using that science in an appropriate way? So it's that kind of thinking that led us a few years ago to do a project on Maine's climate future, which was the state-level climate change assessment. In other words, we've got IPCC for the globe, and we've got national and regional, but Maine has its own unique characteristics from the ecosystem level as well as from a human standpoint, economics, sociology, and history. And so how is climate change affecting Maine? Because that's what Maine people will be most motivated by. And so that's what that assessment did, and from that has been an effort to look at increasingly at adaptation, because these changes are happening around us, and how can we minimize the negative and maximize the positive. So I know the most about the ecosystem side from the things that I do in forests and other kinds of soil plant systems. But I'm also interested in the broader initiatives on adaptation that cut across all the sectors, although I'm not an expert in marine and other areas as well. So that's kind of the breadth of how my science sort of extends to both the classic primary science that we do at the ecosystem scale, as well as the outreach of that science to the public good. And thus, you know, lots of my activities with the Climate Change Institute.
So you're hoping, in a way, that your work informs public understandings of climate change and the effects of climate change?
Yep, exactly.
Now, it seems to me that within the scientific community, there's no real debate about global warming and the human role in creating global warming. But outside the scientific community, in American political culture, it seems to be an issue very much still up for debate. Can you comment as to why you think that might be the case?
I probably would have a different job and be rich if I actually knew the answer to that question. But I think it's a partly a function of our time and where we are in our culture. And I'm not a social scientist, so I'm clearly a novice as I say these things. But we live in an era, of course, where lots of information gets moved quick. Attention spans are really short. That if there's two sides of an issue, or even if they're just opinions, they will get disproportionate attention based on how many sides of the opinion there are, not about the level of confidence in either side of that opinion. So we hear a lot about the issue of uncertainty with climate change. Every time there is a change in what was predicted, every time we have a really cold winter, every time it doesn't get as hot as it did last year, there's a very large amount of coverage, I think, in the media, as well as, you know, institutes and components of society capitalizing on that to try to say that climate change is not happening. So the public, who are really busy with their lives doing what they do, only have snippets of time to hear about this issue and hear both sides and feel ambivalent. And the pendulum swings from the era of you know, Al Gore's height a few years ago to politically the Tea Party era, probably is what it will be referred to, that changed some of the political momentum. And if you're not in this arena and you're just looking at the news for coverage of what's this issue about, you're going to feel like it's somewhat all over the place. And you're not really sure where the truth lies. And we're all like that with lots of issues. And I'm like that as I try and figure out what's going on with the finances of America and, you know, read editorials. So I think climate change is no different in that regard, from the standpoint of why the public seems ambivalent. You're right. There's scientifically some aspects that are debated. There is no debate. Some aspects that are debated, there's some small debate. So there's a couple percent of people who feel like this may be something different. But the vast majority of people that are in those sciences are in agreement that we've altered the climate system of our planet. And one of the areas that I think a lot about and talk about is adaptation, which is, what do we do about it? And we're in an era now where, 5 years ago, if I talked about that, people would say, what do we do about it and when's it going to happen? Now, people are saying, oh, we see these changes. And some are asking, is that climate change? And others don't care, but they know the change is happening. And that's probably what I'm most motivated by, is that these changes are real. Sea level's rising. We have a longer growing season. Rainstorms are more intense. So, when you say global warming, totally fine. I know what you mean by that. But I avoid saying global warming because it's not just the warming. And in a lot of cases, it's not the warming at all that's the most important factor. It's these other changes that are taking place. Less snow melt, less snow coverage. Some of them are bad only because we're not prepared to adjust fast enough. Some of them are bad because they're bad. So when you have Hurricane Sandy hit the New Jersey coastline, there's nothing good about that. When you say, Maine's going to be warmer and like Connecticut, and oh my goodness, the world's going to go to heck in a handbag. Well, they're pretty happy in Connecticut. And they have a vibrant agriculture. So it's not that it's going to change. It's just, are we prepared for that change? Mm-hmm. Sure, there will be ecosystems. Sure, humans will survive it. But, we feel like, particularly in the economic times we're in, I think, we feel like we live on the margin. The economy's been in a slump, and there's lots more disparity in the distribution of wealth in our country. How we can afford to accommodate is a really big question. And I'm motivated to see more happening in adaptation so that we can be as smart as possible with the minimal cost and the most advantage. And in some cases, there's new opportunities. If you can grow peaches in Maine, that's new. And maybe we can. Maybe we can develop a market there. We have a longer growing season. So the issue of climate change is a broad one, and it encompasses in the public mind mostly, I think, the political argument that goes on about mitigation, about the release of greenhouse gases, primarily from energy production, and whether that's a cause of climate change. And the average person, understandably, is saying, gosh, if I'm suddenly going to spend a lot more money on energy because I've got to use less of this fossil fuel stuff, that's going to, kill us as far as our budget goes and our affordability to do it. And I think there's some doubt from what I hear. So why do I want to do that? I think that's where a lot of the public is, understandably, because of what they are exposed to. I'm not saying that aspect is not wrong, but the doubt that we're causing it is pretty small. And the reality that what we're dealing with now is here, and we're already spending whether it's crop failures or whether it's Hurricane Sandy and sea level rise. And so I'm more interested, can we be smarter about coordinating adaptation so that we can be protected from surprises as well as be able to adapt in the most economically and socially acceptable manner. And that works best by being anticipatory rather than just waiting for bad things to happen and then responding. And so that issue is not part of the dialogue, I think, that we hear every day about the climate change issue.
What efforts do you think the Climate Change Institute has made at educating the public about climate change?
Well, a lot. I think everyone in the Institute that I know of has been involved in one way or another in educating the public on a number of different levels, from talking with federal and state legislators, providing testimony, giving public talks, working with teachers and students, K-12, doing interviews, providing information about what climate change is, as well as some key information about, what are the rates of change taking place. The Institute has some of the world's experts on what's happening with ice melt in Greenland and Antarctica. And so there's a general level of expertise across the entire Institute that contributes, I think, on these various levels, as well as some globally unique experts that are informing policy and the public to the extent that that works, but that's the other discussion we just had. On the issue of climate change, what's happening now, what we can expect in the future.
Mm-hmm. How do you think, you've sort of been involved in the Institute in one way or another for a while. You were maybe an outsider for a little while, at mm-hmm. least formally, but mm-hmm. now you're a formal member. Over the years, how have you seen the Institute change?
Well, as you point out, I have not been formally part of the Institute for my entire time here at the university, so it's just been in the last decade that I've been increasingly involved and formally a part of the Institute. I think the Institute's been known as a world-class group of scientists, primarily earth scientists, that dealt with the impacts of glaciation on our landscape and the interaction between climate and glacial cycles and geomorphology and geology. That's what I knew them best as many years ago. And Dr. Morns, what started the Institute, and grew from there. It's focused on the Quaternary, grew to then encompass, I think, anthropology, archaeology, paleoecology, as new components were added to the Institute. And I was not in the Institute during those times, so I can't speak to that evolutionary process for the Institute. And that process pretty much continues to the present, and I'm an example of a continuation of that, sort of modern time ecosystem ecologist, soil scientist, biogeochemist, dealing with atmosphere-landscape interactions. Mm-hmm. So I think I lost the thread of your question then. So that's my perspective of the history or the short arc of where it started and how it's grown. It didn't migrate from its original base, and I think its core expertise is in many ways similar to what it's always been. It's earth sciences with deep time is the fundamental underpinning of what it's best known for. But based on that central strength, it now is a much larger institution with various people contributing new disciplines and everything from science to outreach and social science.
You'd said that so earth sciences is essentially the core of the institute, although it bills itself as an interdisciplinary,
which it is now, yeah.
Institute.
Yeah.
So I guess how important do you think that is? I mean, do you think that the glaciologists are basically working with each other, or do you see much collaboration between disciplines?
Well, I think there's a lot of collaboration between disciplines. I mean, the Institute, by its nature, is a collection of people that are variously appointed elsewhere, as well as the Institute. Mm-hmm. So you've got me in forestry and another faculty member, and several in biology and earth sciences. So by its nature, it really is interdisciplinary. And also by its nature, there's, lots of collaboration because of shared interests and interactions on various events. In fact, I'm going to leave for yet another one this afternoon as soon as we're done here, where the Institute's going to get together and everyone's going to stand up and in one slide, 90 seconds, say what they do, so that new members, students, and as well as faculty, get an initial sense of what everyone's about, and we'll have time to interact and talk about mutual interests, and that's how those collaborations grow. And then the other end of the academic year, there's the annual Bornes Symposium, named after Professor Bornes, where everyone gives a little more lengthy scientific papers, and that goes on for 2 days. And so there's lots of those kinds of opportunities and events that take place within the Institute that provides a great platform for collaborations, getting to know each other. And almost everyone in the Institute is also very active in their scholarly efforts and collaborating with lots of other people. So the sort of the network grows quite easily.
Mm-hmm. What do you think has been the Institute's most important contribution to our understanding of climate?
Oh, my goodness. I would not dare hazard a guess. I think probably, I couldn't say. The Institute has done a lot of amazing things to contribute to our understanding of the interactions between our climate system and our terrestrial environments and our aquatic environments. I think they're known for some critical work in that comes from interpreting ice cores and interpreting the landscapes that are a product of glacial processes to allow us to understand the history of our planet. And from that, also the work in anthropology and archaeology has provided really important insights on how civilization and human civilization over time has been influenced by climate. Paul's works is key in bringing us an understanding of abrupt climate change. So those are the kinds of disciplinary areas that I think the Climate Change Institute stands out globally for their level of expertise. But lots of people in the Institute are doing lots of cool things.
What did you think when the name was changed from the Quaternary Institute to the Climate Change Institute? Did that seem to narrow the focus of the Institute?
Well, not for me. Now, I wasn't formally a part of it when it was the Quaternary Institute, so I only became formally part of it when it was the Climate Change Institute, and it probably led to that being more likely for me. I think of the Climate Change Institute name as being much broader. than the Quaternary Institute. That may be a little bit of function of being more familiar with the terminology, both as far as the geologic period it refers to and what many of the scientists that work in that era do. But anyway, I thought of that as more focused in the earth sciences, whereas I think of the Climate Change Institute as having a broader mission. Given the era that we live in relative to climate change itself, I thought it was a great new title and better matched the need and the mission of the Institute.
So, building off of an earlier question, in your own work, what would you point to as the contribution you've made that you're most proud of?
It'd be a little bit hard to differentiate between two of them, and I'm not sure where either of them end up. But from my, what I say in a sort of tongue-in-cheek way, but from my day job, from the biogeochemistry research that I do, it's undoubtedly the what we learn by doing long-term whole ecosystem level research. And so a lot of my research has been focused on a handful of studies that ranged everywhere from 5 years to 25 years, where we did a lot of research on a particular site, studied all facets of ecosystem function, of course, including soils. And what we learn is that what we find out in the first year and what we find out inside of a three-year grant, which is typical, is often quite different from what we know when we've studied a system over decades. And lots of the questions we're asking, lots of the questions that Congress asks and the public asks of our science, is not what's going to happen in a short time period. It's what's going to happen over a longer time period if we control this pollutant, if we control climate change. And so there's a lot of examples, I think, of us not really having a good idea of the answer to those questions. So in a general way, I think some of the research that we've done that has demonstrated the importance of understanding ecosystem processes over longer timescales than just a couple of years is probably the most important contribution in its refining our thinking about how we should use science in developing policy. The other area I'm proud of is the involvement during my more recent institute years with the climate change assessment and how that has driven state-level initiative on adaptation because of the winds of politics in Augusta and the changes in administration that formally was dropped, and so now there's an effort at the grassroots level, but I continue to participate on behalf of the Institute and the university in trying to move that forward, and I think we'll see that at the federal and state level again in the future. So that climate assessment gave us a framework to do that, to move forward, and I think important in leveraging it. And as we go forward, in the small ways that I might contribute to that larger adaptation effort, I think are really important. And after, you get to a certain point where I can spend a little bit of my time doing that, and whether I publish one or two more papers, I'm probably not going to change the course of history. But if we don't change our society to address some of the concerns relative to climate change and energy and ecosystems, I think we're in trouble, and I have children, I have grandchildren, and so I think the most important thing I can do now is even a little bit that moves us in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's all the questions I have, but before I conclude the interview, I do want to give you an opportunity to maybe add something that I didn't ask you about.
Well, I think you've done a wonderful job.
Well, thank you.
Guiding our discussion here. And it was pretty open-ended, so you let me ramble on. And so I think I really got to many of the things I would want to share. I think we have a challenge as an institute, as higher education and research institutions, all to some extent, is how do you fund the scientific enterprise to continue to do the good things that it's doing, and I would argue for the Climate Change Institute, the great things that it's doing, as well as focus on addressing some of the problems that are before us in a more meaningful way. And there's a lot of expertise and a lot of knowledge that exists in a place like the Climate Change Institute. And on one hand, we need that, and the continual production of that going forward. So we need places like the Climate Change Institute and people like the, really accomplished scientists that are in the Climate Change Institute. Perhaps beside me, but nevertheless, lots of really valuable, important scientists to society. On the other hand, we know well more than we need to do a way better job providing for the future of our country and our neighborhoods and our families and our planet. So, the one thing I would probably add to everything we just said is that our challenge, I think, is to figure out how to distribute our energies and our expertise to do both the bigger basic science mission as well as to make a difference. And I say that partly because I've been around for a while, so I'm obviously not at the beginning of my career, and so you think in different ways later in your career. But partly because I think some of these issues are demanding attention like no other time prior to this. And so I'm hopeful that we can make a better connection with our science and participate in implementing adaptation as well as mitigation for the climate change concern. We'll see.
All right. Well, thank you once again for participating in
this interview. Our battery lasted.
Our battery lasts.